The role that an analyst plays is so important in terms of how people can be wounded, shamed, hurt in a variety of different ways that we need to be very thoughtful about our own residual psychopathology, because no analyst is perfectly analyzed. And it's a lifelong stretch that we go through to try to figure out what is bothering us with a particular patient.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Glenn Gabbard. Dr. Gabbard has been serving as a consultant to analysts and other mental health professionals for decades now. They go to him when they feel stuck in a clinical situation, and we spend some time speaking about what stuckness is. He's also somebody who has thought about, written about, and worked with many clinicians who are struggling with boundary issues with patients, and we spend some time discussing that. Dr. Gabbard is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, and he's also a training and supervising analyst at the Center for Psychoanalytic Studies in Houston. He's the author or editor of 29 books, including some well-known works called Love and Hate in the Analytic Setting, Textbook of Psychoanalysis, Boundaries and Boundary Violations, and The Psychology of the Sopranos, the TV show. He's also the author of 365 scientific papers. He was awarded the Sigourney Award in 2000 and received the Lifetime Achievement Award from Sapienza University in Rome in 2021. And he was the joint editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Psychoanalysis from 2001 to 2007. As you will hear, Dr. Gabbard deserves his reputation as being an analyst's analyst. You can tell he is thoughtful. He is a deeply immersed clinician. He's a fine and well-regarded and widely sought-after teacher. And I hope you enjoy this conversation as I do. Here is my talk with Dr. Glenn Gabbard. Glenn, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Harvey.
Glenn, we all know what it's like to feel stuck in a clinical situation, and there are a host of factors that contribute to it. From the patient's side, what we often encounter are individuals who, outside the office, are addictively involved with self-destructive activities, provocations of people outside the office, and they feel to us often unreachable in their addictive attachments. Some individuals bring it into the office, and are likewise unreachable, but it's through their literal and syntonic reading of the relationship where the love and the hate and the combination thereof is so intense and so literal that it feels that we can't make any headway. And likewise, from the side of the analyst, we too get stuck. We get stuck in, at times, sadomasochistic enactments and preoccupations, and we too get caught in literal love and hate. And you've written about this and you've spoken about this, and I've heard you say, at such times, I never feel alone in my office, referring to the introjects you and hopefully we have of teachers, of analysts, of colleagues, of writers, and that they offer us guidance when we feel we need it. But sometimes these introjects aren't sufficient, and we need an actual person outside of us. And we turn to colleagues or study group members or supervisors or consultants. And Glenn, you've been a consultant for many years, and you've worked with analysts who have sought help, patients who have sought a third opinion, or even institutes who have struggled what to do with a member who's in trouble. So we're going to get to that today and learn from your experience as a consultant. But start us off with what stuckness means to you when you feel that way, what it's like conceptually, what it's like emotionally. And from there, we'll go to the role of the consultant.
Well, the feeling varies, but one common thing that I would say occurs with me is when a patient is coming to see me and I have a kind of sigh of, oh dear, mm-hmm. You know, what do I have that's new to say with this guy? Or this gal doesn't really listen to me, but I need to do my best to pay attention. What comes to mind, Harvey, is many of these people have a narcissistic streak where they really want to have an audience. They don't necessarily want to work on changing something. And in that sense, sometimes I feel used as well as stuck. So one of the things I've done for years is to have regular consultations. There are two people over the years I've used, and I do the same for them. It's reciprocal. If I'm stuck with something, I ask somebody who's outside the dyad and can give me some good ideas, and that person at another time may be asking me what I think. But a critically important aspect of this is analysts get into trouble when they try to be the Lone Ranger and they don't have other people that they can talk to. Because all of us have to remember that we can't see ourselves in the way that a consultant would, or can't see the patient in the way a consultant would, and sometimes. So we have to be open to our limits.
And the example you gave of your own consultation, it stands in marked contrast to the narcissistic patient you were describing, who really doesn't know how to collaborate, doesn't have a sense of mutuality. And you counter that by being deeply involved in just that with a colleague.
Yes, exactly.
Let's talk about some of the situations you have been sought out as a consultant. You're, of course, well known for working with colleagues who've gotten into boundary violation trouble. But before we get to that, your experience is broader than that. And what kinds of problems do people come to you with?
Well, one of them would be the bored colleague who dreads seeing a certain patient and finds his or her mind wandering. And another variation on that is the patient who is charming and funny. And the therapist or analyst often feels like he or she's watching a show, getting some good laughs out of it, and they feel kind of guilty because they feel they haven't done anything. There's a certain kind of charming patient that can make it difficult to get psychoanalytic work done. So those are ones I've had in the past. But also I would say that there's a certain kind of patient who is always wanting to show the analyst that he or she is smarter. And this often results in either listening and kind of losing the losing what the patient is trying to get across, or just disconnecting and thinking about what I'm going to eat tonight, that sort of thing.
Sure. Let me read a couple of sentences from a paper you wrote about your work as a consultant.
Okay.
Quote, "The analyst's insecurities and anxieties are center stage, given the fact that he has explicitly requested the help of the consultant. The emphasis is on what the analyst does not know, the analyst's lack of understanding. His self-doubt, anxiety, dread, shame, guilt, etc., are all exposed to a colleague in an act of faith. The experience of one's own limits as an analyst and as a person, and the acceptance of those limits by the consultant, help shape the analyst's identity in the direction of humility, curiosity about himself, and the awareness that his own analysis is a lifelong task." That's quite a responsibility you take on when you function as a consultant.
Yes. And I think the role that an analyst plays is so important in terms of how people can be wounded, shamed, hurt in a variety of different ways, that we need to be very thoughtful about our own residual psychopathology, because no analyst is perfectly analyzed. And it's a lifelong stretch that we go through to try to figure out what is bothering us with a particular patient. And, you know, the other thing that I think important is there's an educational aspect to getting a consultant. You learn something about yourself or about the patient that you didn't know. So it all around, I think it's a good thing for us to think of having consultants on a regular basis. I've had the two I use have gone on for over 25 years. They know me
but
well.
But you're describing something different than someone's struggling and has a one-off or a two-off with someone that they have connection with. You're describing, in your own situation, an ongoing relationship where you're sort of buddy with each other to keep an eye out and be insightful to what we are bringing to our patients.
Yes, but I've also had periodic consultations with one person for one time, because I know that one person knows something about the problem of the patient.
Right. Can you give us an example? Understand that these are not literal people who have come to you. These are composites, but just to demonstrate so that we can get a feel for what kind of encounters you have as a consultant.
Sure. I think one of the things that I commonly encounter is someone who is having sexual feelings towards a patient and is deeply concerned about somehow deteriorating into a kind of romantic relationship, or at least friendly relationship, and they're in a position of not being able to sort of get themselves out of it because they're charmed or they're intoxicated with the patient. And this is the kind of person I've always in my lectures and writings said, go get a consultant if this starts happening, because you can stop this slippery slope from going on down into the gutter.
Let me ask you a question about that. You're describing an analyst feeling aroused or intoxicated in his, we're using the classical example, but it obviously is not limited to male analysts and female patients, but for example, and he's feeling intoxicated. Now, that's not a very unusual feeling, and yet you're saying it can be the slippery slope. But feeling intoxicated, I would think, is an important communicative aspect of the patient's life experience, that perhaps, let's say, they were intoxicated by something either arousing or terrifying, and the way they are communicating it in their analysis is unknowingly for the analyst to feel it. So it's not the feeling itself, I presume you're describing, that's problematic, but the sense of drowning in it, is that a fair way to characterize what you're saying?
Yes, I think so, Harvey. The people that would come to me because they're feeling that way are having the sense that they're sinking in a way that they can't get back above water. I'll give you an example. Yeah. A very competent female analyst was seeing a man who was a kind of smooth talker and charmer who probably had some antisocial aspects to him. And she found herself laughing repeatedly at this guy's comments. And at one point, when a session ended, she said a song went through her head, and the song was, "Let's give him something to talk about." And she said, "Why am I singing that song or thinking that song unless I'm in some danger of capitulating to this guy and giving people something to talk about?" Now, fortunately, she caught herself doing that and then talked to me about it. But that's a great example of the slippery slope when you start thinking about yourself as, you know, maybe we could do something that's completely outside of psychoanalytic work and get away with it somehow. And and she was very helped by just about three or four consultations.
Do you find, or does the analyst consulting you find, that in addition to their own drowning, to use that imagery, that it also does inform about something happening in the patient, that they themselves, perhaps in childhood, were overstimulated, were worried about secrets and guilts, and that her experience was informative about that?
Oh, yes. I think definitely that's involved. And, you know, there's another dimension of this that I think many people who become analysts somehow feel they weren't loved sufficiently or correctly or enough. And so they may be more prone to get kind of stuck in a situation where they end up saying, "I love you," to a patient, and desperately trying to save the patient. That's another theme that we should mention here, it's very common for a therapist who's treating a patient with suicidal feelings to get into the rescue role. And I remember one time a guy that I consulted with, he was starting to feel like, "I can't get this patient to keep from going down the tubes," in other words, committing suicide. And he said to her, when she said, "No one loves me," he said, "I love you." And then the woman became very upset with him and said, "You're a professional. I pay you. It's not the same thing." And he wanted to say to her, "What do I have to do to convince her that she's loved?" And you know, this is what he was coming to me with. He knew that, you know, he was going out on a limb, but he wanted to talk to me because he had fallen prey to a common theme in our field where if I just show enough love to this person, yeah, he will kind of snap out of it, feel desired, wanted, and then, you know, she'll stop being suicidal. Well, this guy saw me a few times, and then later on, he was charged with sexual misconduct. So they did go on to have a sexual relationship.
Mm-hmm. Do you find, if you're able to discern this, that such individuals who were too literally using love in an attempt to heal, that the issue wasn't explored in their own analysis, that there was something about their own wish to be loved that was never unpacked in their own work?
Yes, that's a good point that you've made, Harvey, because I think that there are a fair number of people who become analysts or therapists because they feel they did not get the love they wanted, and they hope they can make up for that by working with patients. And I've evaluated or been involved in consultations of nearly 300 people in the field. And that's a recurrent theme that you see. Someone who thinks, you know, I need to get the love I didn't get before, maybe a patient will give me that love.
You know, in terms of characteristics of analysts who you see in these situations, let me read a section from your paper on this.
Okay.
You write, it's at times of loss and grief for the analysts that may be high-risk periods for boundary violations. And you recount, a middle-aged analyst once consulted me after his wife's death. He said for the first time in his career, he could finally understand how it was possible for someone to even think about a sexual relationship with a patient. He told me that his loneliness was so intolerable and his neediness so intense that he found himself looking to his patients to take care of him. He told me that several of his patients were thrilled at the possibility that they could reverse roles and take care of him for a change after he had been so helpful to them. He stopped short of embarking on an ill-advised relationship with one of his patients by seeking out consultation after the temptation became hard to resist. That's a better outcome than the one you just mentioned.
Yeah. And I'd just like to take that particular illustration and expand it a bit. There are elderly analysts throughout the United States and other places, I'm sure, who have gotten a kind of a feeling that the patient can help them too. And some of these elderly analysts will talk about the death of their spouse to a patient, or they'll talk about how they're aging and they can't remember things as well, and please forgive me. And they get sympathy from their patient. And this is a problem with people who are not retiring, who should retire. And it comes up frequently in consultations I get of how a person feels like in some way, after all these years of helping people, I should get a little back for myself. And some of my patients, you know, who are doing better, you know, can help me just like I help them. It's kind of quid pro quo. And they don't necessarily do this because of a cognitive impairment, but it's a more of a sense of entitlement that after all these years, I deserve getting something back for myself.
And the place they turn to is their clinical work. It's fine to want to be cared for, of course, as long as one doesn't give up the aspiration to be attentive to the needs of the other.
And Harvey, you know, you're, I'm sure, well aware of this, that, you know, there are analysts who have had patients in treatment for 25, 30, 40 years. They're like a permanent patient. And so often in those cases, it's really become like some kind of mutual rescue effort for each of them. You know, this is a big problem in our field. It's kind of hush-hush, and you don't read about it very much.
And you're not referring to those patients who are involved in a life-saving attachment without which they might genuinely not be able to function or survive. You're talking more about an exploitive,
connection. And I realize there are some, the case you mentioned just now, that somebody who really might need to hang on for a long time with the analyst because it's saving their life, that's different than the analyst who's exploiting.
Certainly. Is there any other clinical example? Because you have been so involved in this that there are a host of areas that I'd like to pick your brain and share with our listeners. Are there other case examples that you have in mind that might demonstrate some points? And then if not, I have other questions for you.
Well, I have so much other material here. I'd rather go on and to other areas.
Okay, great. Sure. Now, you've been around a long time, and you've seen a lot, and you've seen our field grow and change. And I'm interested in what it has looked like to you and what it looks like to you now. This is the practice of psychoanalysis, and where you see it going, both the things that please you about where it may be going and the things that concern you.
Sure. There's certainly been a sea change in how we view psychoanalytic technique. And we're seeing variations on psychoanalytic practice that are in their own way subverting what's been the classic psychoanalytic position. And, there was a time when Brenner and Arlo and well-regarded analysts of that ilk had the view that what psychoanalysis was making the correct interpretation of unconscious conflict, which would lead the patient to be asymptomatic. And most people today would see that as unlikely to happen and kind of maybe a little bit off of the path that an analyst wants to take, because there's a kind of coercive aspect to it. You know, there's a sense that if I'm the patient and my analyst says, you better get rid of this symptom, I'm going to try to pretend happened. Even if I still have it, I want to please the analyst.
Well, wait a second. I mean, are you suggesting that an analyst will say you have to stop the symptom?
No.
I'm having trouble picturing that.
It can be communicated to
unspoken,
the patient that the analyst is quite intensely invested in getting rid of the symptom, and the patient feels they need to comply.
Hmm. It's sort of like you've written about the attachment value of hate. As long as you hate someone, you're attached to them. You're also saying that a symptom can serve that same function. It attaches you to your analyst, albeit sadomasochistically, but nevertheless intensely.
Yeah. Freud came to recognize, and actually in his time, that approaching the patient with the intent of symptom removal underestimates the extent to which patients are attached to their symptoms in a myriad of ways. So, I think the resistance is going to be there, and we have to know how to work with resistance without taking away everything that the patient thinks is valuable. And that's one of the changes that I, in terms of for 45 years doing this, that I think there's more of an awareness that the analyst who's intent on helping the patient relinquish symptoms may be experienced as coercive and may unwittingly intensify the patient's resolve to cling to his symptoms. So I think we're much more open-minded about what we do with symptoms. And I've seen patients where I thought they have to keep this symptom. They're not going to let go of it, and I'm not going to get into an arm wrestling bout with them.
But it shows up in the character and in the transference, yes? Without naming it as a symptom, the characterological matrix within which the symptom lives will live in the dyad.
Yes. But there's another part of this I guess I'm trying to emphasize here, that I think analysis is not a moralizing process in which the analyst conveys some kind of feeling to the patient that you should be different than you are.
Right.
And, you know, this is something I think has gone on too in some cases that I'm aware of. And I think we need to recognize that we're in a different place now. And, you know, there are some analysts that I have a great regard for who will say that we don't really know how patients get better because it varies. And we have to be very careful about trying to say if the analyst changes this symptom or this belief, he will then be fine. And so I think there's a sense of having to live with certain issues that used to be called symptoms and now could be called, you know, part of the person's character or personality.
That's a change. And we are also facing a change of onlineness, to call
yes.
it something. What was your experience like in COVID as we all of a sudden in 24 hours had to change our whole professional lives?
Well, have you got a few hours?
Yeah. Give me the shorter version.
Because it has been an extraordinary time. And so many of my colleagues and I talk about this. And, you know, part of it is I think there's something deadly in our environment. You know, we know we're vulnerable. And, you know, we also know it's the analyst's role to contain anxiety and vulnerability in our patients. But the analyst knows that he or she is also fallible. So sometimes I think what we'll see is the patient may be containing the analyst's anxieties. And we could say that the COVID era has been a great leveler in that sense, where there's more of a sense, Harvey, of two people being in kind of the same condition and kind of helping each other. One of the things I've noticed since back a couple of years ago when all this started was at the beginning of a session, a patient would be saying something like, "Are you okay? No symptoms of any kind?" And I would say, "Yeah, doing fine. How about you?" And it became a kind of the way that a session began with certain patients was to say, you know, "I'm okay, you're okay."
Right.
And that's a quite striking departure. And you have to say the frame has been altered, you know, by the way the virus has affected us.
The challenge at those times, of course, for all of us is while acknowledging reality and the symmetry of the relationship in terms of shared danger, we don't want to lose the opportunity to help the patient learn something about themselves by introducing the consideration that checking in each day we meet also has more to it than just the manifest. And it's tricky when we're all worried.
Yeah, it sure is. And, you know, we have to be aware of what's going on here, that when COVID started, you know, we had to face the fact that all of us were in a traumatic situation where the pall of death was hanging over us like a capricious executioner. You know, it's like any of us could suddenly come down with it. And I think one of the other changes, Harvey, is that there are apocalyptic thoughts that are ubiquitous. You know, things that we're a little irrational about. Can I give you an example from?
Yeah, sure.
One I'm a little bit embarrassed about, but but I think a lot of people are having these kinds of situations. I was seeing a patient on Zoom in my home because I wasn't using my office at this time. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the patient was on Zoom, and a woman probably about 25 or 30. And I heard a pounding on my front door. And I didn't know what to do. I felt sort of de-skilled because here I am with a patient on Zoom.
Sure.
And so she said, "Dr. Gabbard, aren't you going to answer the door?" And I said, "Yeah, of course, sure. Yeah, I'm glad. Exactly. That's where I'm going." A little bit nervously. So I got up and I walked to the door. And before I opened it, I went to a window and looked out the window as if, you know, I might see somebody who was about to break in and shoot me. Hmm. Now, I'm exaggerating slightly, but I was wary of just going to the door when someone knocked. So when I put the curtain aside so I could see outside, this was a FedEx delivery. That's all it was. And the woman was walking back to the van, you know, and she drives.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I felt like an idiot. I thought, why am I acting like this was something outrageous? So I came back in, and my patient says, "Everything okay?" "Well, yeah, no problem," I said. But I realized at that moment that one of the things that's happened with this era is there's been a kind of paranoid anxiety that is pervasive. Actually, some of the studies indicate that anxiety levels are very, very high throughout most of the surveys, and that the paranoid anxiety part is that I could be vulnerable in a way that I haven't been vulnerable before. I didn't ever care about someone knocking at the door from FedEx, but now it has a new meaning to me. And I think there are a number of aspects that this can take. And one of it is when I've talked to patients in my practice about should they date somebody, and they get paranoid about what the virus is doing, how much this person can be believed who says, "I've been vaccinated." So it's part of a larger cultural problem with how vulnerable we are.
And how the analytic situation, which is built on vulnerability, has been changed because in your example and in our common experience of feeling in danger, we are all feeling vulnerable. And as you say, in how patients greet us, there is a real aspect to it, which changes the rhythm of the relationship, at least at moments.
Yes. And, you know, another part of this that I think is worth mentioning is what happens by Zoom itself. And again, I'll give you an example. A female patient was doing Zoom with a female therapist. And the therapist consulted me. And she said, "You know, when I am doing Zoom, the patient is lying in her bed in what looks like some variation of pajamas. And it looks to me like she's being very seductive to me." And then she said, "But I can't bring this up. I can't say to her, you look seductive, because she might be horrified. And besides, it's her house. That's her room that she wants to do the treatment in. And so who am I to say that? So what I'm talking about is a kind of anxiety about saying the wrong thing and misreading something, because the situation of this woman's house is very different than being in an office.
It's such an interesting example of, quote, saying the wrong thing, because, of course, what a patient brings, whether it be in our office or in their home, is intended, intentionally or unconsciously, is intended for us to see and have a reaction to. So I can't imagine that there's anything wrong or harmful or dangerous to make an observation and to understand the meaning of the observation between the two of them. But of course, you're touching on something that's pervasive in our community. To say the wrong thing, to tweet the wrong thing, to use the wrong word is now being dealt with as if it's calamitous. And people's lives are being destroyed because they say the wrong thing. So yes, unfortunately, the analytic third, the point of view that says, let's reflect on this, let's understand the meaning to each of us, is so absent from political and cultural discourse. And I think that's to everybody's disadvantage.
Well, you know, the other part of it, Harvey, is she feels like she's a guest in this person's home, in the person's bedroom. And there's something so unfamiliar about that with any analyst that they don't want to sort of talk in that way, because they feel like, you know, who am I to say this? I'm kind of an invited guest here. And there's something else I'd like to mention in connection with this. Another one of my patients said that she has felt that in some way she should hold herself responsible for the horrid COVID problem. And she said she frequently says, what have I done to bring this on? Then she says, I know it's irrational, but I can't help thinking that I'm responsible in some way. So, you know, when I talk about the paranoid anxieties, there are depressive anxieties going on too. It's such a strange era that we don't know how we fit in with it and who caused what and what should we do about it.
It's an elaboration of what we know for people who have been ill, at times seriously ill. And when you spend time with them therapeutically or analytically, how ubiquitous it is for people to discover the fantasy that they brought this on themselves. And it usually associates with childhood situations and childhood sexuality imaginings, et cetera. And now it's writ large in the culture at large about how we are internally, intrapsychically responsible for harm to everybody.
Yeah,
and Glenn, I do want to ask you one other thing.
Go ahead.
I don't want us to terminate without our talking about termination, because you have written important things about it. And I want to start us off by reading a couple of sentences from your paper on termination. You write, "The problem in theorizing about optimal technical strategies for termination reflects a more general problem in psychoanalytic education and practice. Psychoanalysis as a discipline is about the idiosyncratic, the unique, and the overdetermined. It does not lend itself to reductionistic ideological formulations or generic technical approaches. Idealized models of termination are constructed as a way of attempting to manage the array of different endings in analytic work, all of which call for imperfect choices." Can you summarize, only for lack of time, can you summarize your view of termination? Because it's a vital pivot point in our field.
It is. And I'm so glad we have time to at least discuss it briefly. I have wondered all along my career exactly what is going on at termination. And, you know, one of the most interesting bits of data I have on this is Judy Kantrowitz, who studied this more than anyone else. She did detailed interviews with 82 former analysands. Some were in the profession and some weren't. But one of the things that she noted is that 51 out of the 82 of the subjects sought out further help from the analyst after terminating. And she said the most frequent complaint within this cohort of former analyst Ams was that the analyst had stepped outside the professional role and was unaware of the negative impacts it had on their patients. And many of these former analyst Ams would periodically go back to see their analyst for a session or two, not unlike Freud's caseload, where at least 10 of Freud's 36 patients were seen intermittently over the years as needed. And this is kind of what I was talking about before, that there is an assumption about termination that really doesn't get in depth enough to say, what's going on here? Why is it that people can't terminate? And Bob Wallerstein's study, he said that there were people at the Menninger Clinic for a period of 25 years, and they were, you know, never did terminate and were called therapeutic lifers. And I think this is actually a fairly common thing, but it's a secret of the profession that we don't exactly know how to terminate.
Well, it sounds like it's a similar challenge when people ask us repeatedly during COVID about the literalness, how you're doing, when and how you approach it dynamically about, I don't have to necessarily answer the question every day, let's understand the feeling behind it. So too with termination, there's a manifest issue of, I want to terminate. And at a certain point, if I hear you right, and help me out if I'm not, ordinarily one would address, let's understand where this is coming from and flesh it out. Maybe it will lead to termination. Maybe it will lead to some new understanding versus when you just take it at face value. I don't know if you're suggesting taking it at face value. Help me with this about what's complicated about termination. Is it the fact that it's a breach in the relationship, that it's it is a manifest behavioral request? As opposed to just something else a patient says that we try to understand?
Well, I think it's all of the above. It varies. But I remember something Martin Bergman said years ago. He said, psychoanalysis lacks a paradigm for termination. And he said that the love experienced in the transference may be the best love relationship the patient has ever had, and the patient's not likely to give it up without a fight. So that I think there are many situations that often are kept kind of quiet, where it goes on, and there are, you know, special relationships between a longstanding analyst and the analyst, and they may be going through the motions of analysis, but you have to wonder, is that some kind of denial of the fact that there has to be a termination, that people will be filled with grief on both sides. So I think this isn't very well worked out in the field, but you know, so many of these examples of people who've been in analysis for, you know, more than two decades, and you have to think, what's up here?
Sure. And I had a wonderful conversation, actually it's episode 83 with Judy about her work on termination. And
I know.
She also points out that that many people feel really good at termination. I mean, it's in the face of the predicted, if not demanded, mourning, which of course certainly can take place, but many people felt liberated in a good sense, not in a manic denial sense, but feeling empowered that they can now move on in their life, and they're grateful and touched and attached, but also enjoying the freedom. So there are a host of possibilities in termination, which is what she discovered and what you have emphasized as well. And both of you are devoted to not limiting our understanding to formulas. And that's really, as I've read through much of your work, that stands out to me as a leitmotif of your focus, that you really try to understand the moment without bringing predetermined formulas. Or when you do bring predetermined formulas, you get curious about yourself, what's leading you to fall back on that, because that's not in the analytic moment.
And I respect Judy Kantrowitz tremendously, because she's done the hard work of looking at all these cases and trying to figure out what goes on in termination. And I think there's still a lot that we don't know about the nitty-gritty of terminations, because people don't want to give up the closest relationship they've ever had.
Yeah. Even if it's at the cost of a deeper closeness, which would acknowledge loss and mourning and time.
Yes.
Glenn, we began by talking about stuckness and your graciousness in terms of sharing your own episodes of stuckness, your own collegiality with consultants, and your own in-depth embrace of these analytic moments. You've been a teacher and inspiration for many people, and your writings are so clear and so accessible that you do a great deal to spread unstuckness to those who read and want to learn. We could spend a lot more time. Perhaps we will again in the future, but I want to thank you for taking this time and for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you for your kind words, Harvey, and for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.